Hey, Marketplace listeners, you know, around here, we like to think you're never too young to learn about the economy and financial basics. That's why we're bringing the Million Bazillion Live Tour to school to teach important lessons about budgeting, investing, saving, and more. It's all the fun of the podcast, but now live, immersive, and interactive. Special thanks to our tour partner, Greenlight, the debit card and money app for kids and teens. Learn more about Greenlight at greenlight.com/million. That is greenlight.com/million.
Marketplace is supported by Putnam Investments, celebrating over 70 years of service to financial advisors, their clients, and institutions worldwide. Putnam Investments, a world of investing. Produced in association with the University of Southern California.
It's not quite a story of how the mighty have fallen, but the earnings report from Goldman Sachs this morning was kind of lousy. And yes, I think that was a bit of schadenfreude you heard out there. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Gather.com, the social network where people can make new friends who share their interests. People talking about today's news at news.gather.com. And by Progressive Insurance, helping people shop for car insurance at 1-800-PROGRESSIVE and progressive.com.
From the Frank Stanton Studios in Los Angeles, I'm Kai Ryssdal. It is Tuesday, today the 20th of July. Good to have you with us. Goldman Sachs used to be different, used to be above the fray, if you will, able to make billions of dollars without even trying. That's part of why today's profit report landed with such a thud. It was, to put it kindly, a bit disappointing. Earnings dropped 82%. And yes, part of that can be chalked up to the $550 million the company owes the SEC to settle a lawsuit. Also, the $600 million that went to pay taxes over in the UK. But even so, things do look pretty bleak. Profits in Goldman's trading division were down almost 40%, making the bank look almost human and making us wonder whether Goldman's woes might be a reflection of the state of the economy. Marketplace's Elisa Roth reports.
Goldman's traders are supposed to be the superheroes of Wall Street. But last quarter, their superpowers failed them. Jeff Hart follows Goldman at Sandler O'Neill, and he says with the market going up and down all quarter, it was hard for the traders to guess which way to bet. So it's no surprise they lost money.
It was a bad trading and banking quarter, but it was a bad trading and banking quarter all over. I don't know that there's a management team, a trader, a banker out there that can consistently overcome a really bad, really tough marketplace.
Goldman was hardly the only bank whose trading divisions got beaten up in the second quarter. Traders at J.P. Morgan and Citigroup and B of A all did. Hart says in a crazy market like this one, though, winning isn't the point.
The key there tends to be managing risk exposures for the firm to make sure that, you know, there's no major blow-ups or that they, you know, they're controlling risk well.
And he says by that measure, Goldman's traders did a fine job. Hugh Johnson is chief economist at his own asset management company. And he says for once, Goldman's performance is in sync with the economy.
The earnings really reflect the fact that things changed in this world of ours in the second quarter, and they changed for the worse, unfortunately. And investors became very, very concerned about what the future has in store.
He says investors are pretty good at predicting the future. And if they're right about the way things look now, we can expect another bumpy quarter next time around. In New York, I'm Elisa Roth for Marketplace.
Speaking of bumpy, this has been quite a week for news about the government's bailout of the auto industry. Yesterday, it was poke in the eye for the White House about how it forced GM and Chrysler to shut down thousands of dealerships. Today, courtesy of the Detroit Free Press, comes some hope that taxpayers will get more of their bailout money back than we'd thought. Justin Hyde wrote the story in the paper today. Justin, welcome to the program.
Thanks for having me, Kai.
Let's start with the place that the government has most of its money and thus the greatest possibility of reward, I suppose. General Motors. How are we doing there, the taxpayers?
Well, the Treasury has put about $50 billion into GM over the past couple of years. GM has made some progress. Its sales have come back a little bit. More importantly, it's starting to turn a profit. And as you look forward to see some of the new vehicles that are coming out in the pipeline, things seem to be moving towards a positive direction for the company. We're all kind of expecting that by November, GM will try to put its shares up for sale again in Wall Street.
Explore that for me a little bit. What is the mechanism by which the Treasury Department might divest itself and thus get some of its money back? Do we know yet?
It's not quite clear exactly how fast or how slowly Treasury will unfold itself and unfold its stake. You know, they've made comments in the past about trying to balance getting out of the company as quickly as possible with returning some money to the taxpayer. They don't want to have a fire sale that damages GM's share prices the moment they hit the market. It's going to be a bit of a balancing act to see how they can extricate themselves in this process.
Yeah, speaking of balancing acts, that really is Chrysler in a nutshell, right? You've got employees owning part of the company through their healthcare plan. You've got Fiat is involved, and Washington owns far less of it than they do of GM. What's the state of play there?
They're still getting their ducks in a row. They're not expected to get back into the stock market this year. Their bankruptcy was a lot more disruptive than General Motors was. They've been really trying to get their new vehicle pipeline restarted. The first of those new models is just getting to market. It'll take a couple of years to really see how well new CEO Sergio Marchionne is turning around Chrysler. So in that case, it may be a little bit harder to get Treasury to get out. It may take a little bit longer.
All right. The last one to think about here is Ally Financial, which is, first of all, the company that used to be known as GMAC. It's also an underwriter of this program. Did a lot of auto financing, obviously, across the auto industry, but is wrapped up, as you point out, in the mortgage mess.
Ally Financials was deep in the mortgage market back in the mid-2000s and suffered tremendously when the housing market collapsed. Treasury has said very little about how it tends to get out of Ally. It owns a majority of the company. It's its largest shareholder. The current management at Ally has said their goal is to pay back the government in its entirety. That may be a tough order, but given that the way the financial industry has bounced back in this crisis in the ways that other industries have not, it's possible that Ally may be the best bet that government has right now to get all of its money back.
So net-net, though, of the $86 billion that the government made available to the auto industry writ large over the past couple of years, how much are we going to get back?
Well, right now, the most recent estimate from the U.S. government said that they were expecting to lose about $24 billion. That used some pretty conservative assumptions. We went through, looked at the math again. Our best guess right now is that the government would probably still lose roughly $12. At one point, the government was expecting to lose more than $12 billion on the GM investment alone. So it does certainly mark a recovery from what was expected going into the bankruptcies of GM and Chrysler last year. Still a lost position. There's really no one out there who thinks that the government can break even. But compared to, you know, the financial industry rescue, it's not quite as severe as loss as what once was expected.
Justin Hyde from the Detroit Free Press. He's in the Washington Bureau. Justin, thanks a bunch.
Thank you so much, Kai.
Next time you find yourself stuck in an airplane out on the tarmac for hours at a time, go ahead and count your blessings. Seriously, I mean that. It turns out penalties meant to help travelers may actually be hurting them, as Marketplace's Jeff Tyler reports.
Passengers aren't being stranded inside idle airplanes as often. That's because the government started penalizing airlines when a plane stays on the tarmac for more than 3 hours. Fines run $27,000 per passenger.
Because there are punitive fines at hundreds of times the amount of revenue that's on board the airplane, what we're seeing is that airlines are very risk-averse. They're bringing those flights back to the gate long before 3 hours.
That's Joshua Marks of Marks Aviation and one of the authors of a new study.
What we've seen is that for every flight where you save a tarmac delay, four flights are getting canceled.
Marks estimates that around 200,000 passengers will have flights canceled in the next year, and those passengers will wind up being delayed for an average of 17 hours. But some say these estimates are premature. Henry Hartefeld is an airline analyst with Forrester Research.
What I'm concerned about is the studies trying to write the end of the show when the first act isn't even finished yet.
With only 1 month's worth of data, he says the study may overestimate the problem. But if high cancellations persist after 6 months, Hartefeld thinks the 3-hour tarmac rule should be reconsidered.
This was done to protect the traveler, but if it ends up penalizing travelers and inconveniencing people, then this 3-hour limit ends up being really the wrong kind of rule to have.
Hartefeld says the airlines, the FAA, and airport executives should sit down in a few months to iron out the kinks. Otherwise, the consumer protections meant to streamline the process may continue to cause delays. I'm Jeff Tyler for Marketplace.
The session on Wall Street this Tuesday started out being quite inconvenient. Ended strong, though. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. The news yesterday that BP has spent almost $4 billion on the oil spill so far brings us this today. The oil company said it's agreed to sell off some natural gas fields in Vietnam. It'll net about $1.7 billion, money that will go to the compensation fund, the White House demanded. There will, of course, be many other demands on BP's coffers. It is facing hundreds of lawsuits, which has presented an interesting dilemma for some university scientists. Marketplace's Amy Scott reports.
By law, BP is required to help assess the ecological damage from the Gulf oil spill. So the company's been hiring scientists like Joe Griffith at the University of Southern Mississippi's Gulf Coast Research Lab. He says BP offered him around $150 to $200 an hour to help draw up its response plan. He and a few colleagues initially signed on.
It was an opportunity to, we thought, do some good working with BP. And we thought if we were on the inside, you know, we could push on that side, too, and make sure that whatever BP's plan was scientifically valid.
But when they found out they might have to testify on BP's behalf in court, Griffith and his colleagues resigned. Bob Shipp is chairman of marine sciences at the University of South Alabama. He says his department declined to work with BP because the company wanted to restrict how the research would be used.
Consulting is fine. It's part of academia. Most everyone consults, but you do it in an open manner. Consulting with strings attached is not fine.
In an email to Marketplace, a BP spokesman said the company has hired a number of experts to assist in both its legal defense and its response plan. He said the company has placed no restrictions on environmental data. Separately, BP has pledged $500 million over 10 years for scientific research in the Gulf. At least $30 million has been doled out so far, no strings attached. I'm Amy Scott for Marketplace.
Hartz Goodwin was sworn in as the new junior senator from West Virginia today. He replaces the late Robert Byrd and, in the process, becomes the Democrats' 60th vote. The majority party used that vote to break a GOP filibuster on a bill this morning that will extend unemployment benefits for about 2.5 million Americans. Younger workers have been harder hit than most in this recession. Younger as in teenagers. The unemployment rate for 16 to 19-year-olds in this economy is 29%. So college students on summer break have been taking jobs they might normally try to avoid, like flipping burgers or working the tilt-a-whirl for queasy kids. And that means the people who usually get those kinds of jobs aren't. From Birmingham, Alabama, Gigi Duban reports.
Rashad Murphy will be a freshman in college this fall, so his summer job search was pretty extensive.
Almost anywhere that took applications. Let's see, like Foot Locker, Finish Line, Target, Walmart.
Instead, he ends up here at Alabama Adventure, an amusement park where he works a big wooden roller coaster.
Welcome back to the station. How is all of everybody?
He gives the safety talk. He locks lap bars. He turns away people who are less than 48 inches tall. The job pays $7.25 an hour. There are no health benefits. And when summer ends, the job ends. Oh, and it's 97 degrees outside. Even so, Alabama Adventure's job fair in March drew more than 600 people, compared to 250 in years past. Many of those were college students like Murphy, who seemed to be edging out foreigners. Overseas workers typically help staff summer hotspots like resorts and rest stops. Tony Sanders is Alabama Adventure's human resources director. He says last year the park cut its international recruitment program and hired locals instead.
It's usually a very successful program, but we wanted to keep it at home.
Others are doing the same. Companies that connect foreign students with American employers report that business is down. From 2007 to 2009, the number of seasonal employees not working on farms has dropped more than 60%, according to the Department of Homeland Security. Sanders says the foreign students were great workers, but there were aspects of the program that were a bit cumbersome.
Some of the language barriers and got to deal with at the end of the year, their W-2s and mailing of information and checks and everything.
There was housing to arrange, transportation. But the overseas students did offer one key benefit. They arrived in the U.S. early and stayed late. so they were able to work through the end of the season when many here were gearing up for school. But foreigners aren't the only ones who are being crowded out. High school students are too. For one thing, they arrive on the scene later.
And a lot of students will say, oh, it's the end of May, it's time to get a job, but they're a good month and a half behind at that point. So.
But teenagers need jobs too, according to Michael Saltzman. He's a research fellow at the Employment Policies Institute.
I think younger teens are missing out on those important skills you learn in a first job. As far as, you know, at amusement park, how to deal with, you know, ornery customers at a restaurant. Maybe it's how to deal with the shift manager, whether it's how to punch a time card. These are the kind of skills you need to move ahead in the labor force.
And Saltzman says teens that fail to land that first job are worse off in the long term.
And if you do get discouraged, I think you are at risk of being more likely to drop out of high school, to get in legal trouble, or to be at risk of lower wages in the future.
And that creates a ripple effect that goes way beyond the water park. In Birmingham, I'm Gigi Dubin for Marketplace.
Coming up, bitter truths about the bitter end.
When you look at the healthcare system as a whole, there are competing streams of revenue that could keep patients away from facing their dying. You know, everybody has, if you will, a dog in the end-of-life care fight.
But first, let's do the numbers. The Dow Industrials added 75 points today, about 0.75%, closed at 10,229. The NASDAQ rose 24 points, right around 1%, finished at 2,222. The S&P 500 ticked up 12 points, just over 0.1%, ended things at 1,083. PepsiCo shares bubbled up 0.33% today after the soft drink maker reported more than $1.5 billion in quarterly profits. Harley-Davidson cruised up nearly 14% after the company announced higher profits. Investors took it as a sign discretionary spending is stabilizing. Meantime, Wall Street apparently shrugged off disappointing profits from Goldman Sachs. As we mentioned, down more than 80% those numbers. Still, shares rose more than 2% today. Bonds rose. The yield on the 10-year T-note fell to 2.95%. And you're listening to Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Ally Bank, committed to customer service with the option to reach a human being at any time at 877-247-ALLY by pressing 0. And by Reputation Defender, helping doctors, lawyers, and small business owners monitor, protect, and improve their online reputations. ReputationDefender.com/market. Let us give you the business 24 hours a day. Just tap marketplace.org into your mobile phone for the latest financial news and reports from around the globe on how the economy is affecting our lives.
From the Marketplace Datebook, here's a look at events coming up Wednesday. In Washington, Fed Chairman Ben Bernanke delivers his semi-annual monetary policy report before the Senate Banking, Housing, and Urban Affairs Committee. The House Judiciary Committee holds a hearing titled Ensuring Justice for Victims of the Gulf Coast Oil Disaster. And it's intended to bring greater security to folks on Main Street. President Obama is scheduled to sign the Wall Street Reform and Consumer Protection Act. I'm Michelle Phillippe.
This is Marketplace from American Public Media. I'm Kai Rizdahl.
I'm going to sit right down and write myself a letter.
If this is a Tuesday and we're playing that music, it must be your turn. This week, we're going to start our letters segment with credit and an interview we did about what the American credit score landscape looks like. This is the sentence in question from that interview.
Your credit score doesn't really matter at all if you're not in the market for credit.
That filled up our inbox with a lot of you saying, hold on just a second now. Aaron Kalavakalanu from Miami, Florida, wrote to point out that you need a good credit score to rent an apartment nowadays, and that's not by any means the least of it.
If you're in the market for insurance, your credit score would be used as one of the inputs to determine the rate that would be quoted to you. Number two, if you're applying for a job, your credit score may be held against you.
We did a story a couple of weeks ago about health insurance companies and how they're trying to improve customer relations over the phone. They hire other companies to handle their calls and, in essence, manage that phone relationship with you. Not, it is fair to say, a popular strategy with listeners to this public radio program. You're not buying the "I do apologize that you had to go through this" shtick that you get when you get the call. Kurt Wall of Washington, D.C. summed it up. "It's really all about sincerity," he wrote. "Once you've learned to fake that, the rest is easy." Last week, our Transportation Nation project brought you a story about cities trying to get rid of highways to make more space for, you know, people. Gail Fairbanks lives in Chapel Hill, North Carolina, vacations frequently in San Francisco, and she says the city by the bay getting rid of the Embarcadero Freeway is about the best thing that could have happened.
Now the citizens enjoy a beautiful bayfront playground, including access to the piers, beaches, and avenues that have generated successful farmers markets, retail, and outdoor activity.
We'll go back on the road now to wind things up. Our Road Warriors series talks to business travelers about what music they listen to get them through their travels. We heard from Tim Westergren a couple of weeks ago. He's the chief strategy officer at the internet radio company Pandora. Late by Ben Folds is a favorite of his, as it is with Steve Noble from Hackettstown, New Jersey. But Steve doesn't just insert the earbuds and crank up the iPod to get by. Oh, no.
My preference is to seek out the local karaoke bar and sing my heart out. And Ben Folds is a favorite choice.
Usually it's a song called Landed.
We hit the bottom. I thought it was my fault. And I guess in a way that it was.
If you've got a favorite Ben Folds song or a comment or a question or you just want to sing on the radio, please let us know. Our homepage is marketplace.org. The link you need is in the top right-hand corner. It says contact. We're going to take some time now on a subject most of us don't want to think about, much less talk about: death and the process of dying. People 85 and older are the fastest growing part of the American population. They are also the sickest. End-of-life care is one reason why we're spending more on health care as a country than we ever have. In the first of two stories about the changing economics of the way we die, Marketplace's Caitlin Carroll explains how we got here.
First, a little background. I love the movie Cocoon. I first saw it 21 years ago when I was 10. It's about a group of senior citizens who find alien eggs in a swimming pool, and the pool turns into a kind of fountain of youth.
What's important is that when we get where we're going, we'll never be sick, we won't get any older, and we won't ever die.
When I saw the movie, someone in my family was dying. I wanted a supernatural force to intervene. I was a child, but many people take that kind of magical thinking with them into adulthood.
It was once said that Americans believed that death was optional.
That's Howard Gleckman. He's a fellow at the Urban Institute and the author of Caring for Our Parents.
There may be such a thing as American exceptionalism, but death isn't optional.
Even if it feels that way sometimes. Respirators, pacemakers, and dialysis machines can keep our organs functioning when they no longer work so well on their own. New drugs and treatments stave off the effects of chronic diseases like cancer and AIDS for years. As a country, we've invested billions in the promise of life-saving technology.
In the mindset of the modern American system, the right thing is more treatment and more stuff, more machines, more drugs.
At least a quarter of all Medicare money is spent on people in the last year of life, mostly in the last month. Much of this spending does help people live longer. But for many, it means being tethered to machines, taking experimental drugs, and undergoing painful treatments. Henry Aaron is a healthcare economist at the Brookings Institution.
At a certain point, layering on additional care, as many people have put it, extends dying but does not really extend life.
The process can also send families into financial ruin. And it's not the way most patients say they want to die. According to the Dartmouth Atlas Project, which tracks healthcare trends, more than 80% of patients say they don't want to be hospitalized or given intensive care during the last phase of their lives. So why are so many getting it? It's simple and complicated. No one wants to give up. Not families, not patients or doctors. And then there's the healthcare system itself.
When you look at the healthcare system as a whole, there are competing streams of revenue that could keep patients away from facing their dying. Everybody has, if you will, a dog in the end-of-life care fight.
That's Don Schumacher. He heads the National Hospice and Palliative Care Organization. It concentrates on helping people with chronic and terminal disease stay comfortable, rather than trying to cure what cannot be cured. What Schumacher means is that the healthcare system is built on incentives that are tied to more care.
You have physicians wanting to continue to treat hospitals, and most of this is motivated by the best of all intentions in that they want to give people what it is that they want, which is the hope that they can survive their illness.
But, he says, when it becomes clear that there's little hope for recovery, doctors need to have frank talks with patients and their families about other options. A provision in the health care reform bill would have paid doctors to talk to patients about living wills and end-of-life care. It collapsed in a national fit of hysteria over death panels.
They would rather send you a $50 check for a blue pill, end-of-life pill, than pay for the necessary medical expenses.
Obamacare is euthanasia. It's rationing.
Rosemary Gibson led the Robert Wood Johnson Foundation's program to improve end-of-life care. She says in addition to not getting compensated for this kind of care, many doctors aren't trained to talk about death.
In fact, in the mid-1990s, if you picked up a medical textbook or a nursing textbook, you would never know that a patient ever died.
Howard Gleckman says he learned his father was dying of congestive heart failure during a random conversation with his father's doctor in a hospital hallway. Gleckman took his father home and stopped looking for more specialists and different treatments. He decided
that the best use of my time was really just sitting with him and helping him remember. That was very gratifying, and it was very helpful to me. It was very helpful to my mother, and I think it was probably very helpful to him as well.
That decision bought them all some time to deal with the inevitable. In Los Angeles, I'm Caitlin Carroll for Marketplace.
Caitlin's story was produced as part of a California Endowment Health Journalism Fellowship. That's a program of the Annenberg School for Communication and Journalism at USC. Tomorrow, how end-of-life care is changing.
Marketplace is supported by Putnam Investments, offering total return strategies designed to match your goals. This is Putnam Today. Additional support from the University of Southern California's Marshall School of Business.
This final note today, two of them, actually not at all related. They just kind of struck me as funny. Item one is that the American Customer Satisfaction Index has included Facebook in its rankings for the first time. Facebook is down there in satisfaction land with the IRS, airlines, and cable companies. Moving on now, item two from the Marketplace desk of I Only Read It for the Articles. Really, I do. Playboy launched a Safe for Work site today, said the company's editorial director. We realized we were missing a chance to get guys when they're online the most at the office, he said, to which the only possible response is, what could possibly go wrong? Anyway, that is Marketplace from American Public Media this Tuesday afternoon. Today, the Dow put on 75 points, about 0.75%. The NASDAQ up 24 points, about 1%. The S&P 500 added 12 points, just over 0.1%. Thanks to Jennifer Collins and Ethan Lindsay on our Morning Report crew. The Marketplace Morning Report is produced by Rod Abid. That's where you can listen tomorrow morning for the latest in business and economic news. Coming up next time on this program, Shanghai's World Expo from the inside.
For many people who are here, you know, this is their first trip outside their home province. And this line of people really represents the rising consumer class of China.
I'm Kai Rizdal. Do hope you can join us for that tomorrow.
American Public Media.
The world can be a confusing place for kids, and finding the words to explain it all can be tricky, too. Introducing Million Bazillion, a Webby-winning podcast from Marketplace that takes your kids on exciting adventures to answer the awkward and complex questions they have about money.
Each week, we tackle hard-hitting inquiries from kid listeners like,
what is a college account and how does it work?
I want to know what unions are and what they are for.
Why does the U.S. have so much gold in Fort Knox and what do they use it for?
Help your kids understand how money fits into the world around us. Listen to Million Bazillion wherever you get your podcasts.